Today is Tuesday, August 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the latest from Indonesia as the death toll from Sunday's earthquake climbs to over 100 as thousands are evacuated.
I'm not sure what we will do. We are still in shock.
Plus, regional countries brace for the implications after the United States has reimposed sanctions on Iran. And India's first disabled dance troupe continues to perform folk dances with some members in their 40s and 50s. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Thousands of people are being evacuated from surrounding islands near the epicenter of a powerful 6.9 magnitude earthquake after it struck the island of Lombok in Indonesia on Sunday. Some Indonesian villagers living close to the epicenter said they have yet to receive any aid.
What we need urgently is food and clean water. And we hope the government will pay attention to the fact that we really need help.
To get more on what's taking place on Lombok and the surrounding islands, I'm joined in the studio by VOA Indonesian service correspondent Leonard Triyono.
Thank you very much for having me.
So earlier today, officials held a news conference giving the latest information on fatalities. The government has updated its numbers from
yesterday. The government keeps on updating the number. The last one until earlier this morning was 98, and then later on they talk about they increased the number into 105. And
do they anticipate that number increasing still as they continue rescue and recovery operations?
I would say so, unfortunately, which is very unfortunate, you know, because there are the structures are not very strong in those places, you know. And, you know, people, it happens, fortunately, still in the early evening, you know. Regardless, there are people at homes and whose houses are not very strong. So they are probably still trapped, you know, inside these structures, including in some worship places, you know, because that's the time when people get together in these places.
How many tourists have been evacuated thus far?
Well, actually, you have a good question. Well, talking about the numbers, well, they were talking about 2,000. I think they just rounded up to 2,000 from those small islands. Don't talk about the larger island of Lombok, which you can say there are probably tens of thousands, because that is only second to Bali, you see.
Mm-hmm. There's also been some reports of people in remote villages who say that they haven't received aid yet. They're still in need of emergency supplies, water, for instance. How is the government trying to address those concerns?
Yeah, the government actually has been trying to get as many volunteers and aid workers as possible in order to help deliver the basic needs, you know, for these people. Problem is, as I said earlier, these people are quite remote and are not very accessible. Plus the fact that it was hit by the first
earthquake,
and then the second earthquake, you know, it has become quite difficult to reach. You know, it's not that the government does not have enough supplies; they do have supplies.
The problem is getting them to these
people who are in need.
Leonard, there was an earthquake on Lombok a little over a week ago from today. Did that have any bearing on what we're currently seeing?
There was like a precursor, you know, like there was an earthquake, a smaller scale actually in magnitude, a smaller magnitude, which is 6.4, but it was a disaster already. It created a lot of problem already, you know, considering the island, which is not unlike develop places like on Java. You know, this is on a remote island.
It's a small, remote tourist island.
Tourist island, actually. This is a tourist destination, actually. So the government has been working hard, and especially in trying to get those people in the smaller islands, you know, called Gili Islands, which consist of three tiny small islands, which are really, really beautiful with the white sand, you know, beaches. And yes, to these tiny islands, but then they were suddenly hit by this thing, you know, and because the islands are small, they were so afraid that a tsunami would come, you know, somehow at some point. And of course, people are very nervous, and there are quite a number of tourists there. I mean, we talk about thousands, you see. And the government has been good, actually, in trying to get them out of those tiny islands.
Leonard Triyono is a correspondent with VOA's Indonesian service. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio.
Oh, my pleasure.
Among other top stories, Congo's health ministry says three more cases of Ebola have been confirmed in North Kivu province as the country faces its 10th outbreak of the deadly virus. The health minister has confirmed at least four Ebola deaths. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has ruled out forming a coalition government despite his narrow win in last week's presidential election. The opposition is gearing up to challenge the official results in court. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton accused North Korea Tuesday of failing to move ahead with denuclearization pledged by Pyongyang leader Kim Jong-un at the Singapore summit in June with U.S. President Donald Trump. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile application. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers say they have made the first radio detection and are the first to measure the strong magnetic field of what could be a planetary mass object outside of our solar system. The astronomers say that the object, called SIMP-0136, is either a gigantic rogue planet, which is a planet without a host star, or possibly a brown dwarf, a failed star. The extrasolar object was first discovered in 2006 by a Canadian-led team as part of the All-Sky Survey known as SIMP. Astronomers who made the more recent findings did so with the National Science Foundation's Carl G. Jansky Very Large Array, or VLA, in New Mexico. The object is about 20 light-years from Earth, has a mass 12.7 times that of Jupiter, and its magnetic field was measured to be 200 times more powerful than Jupiter's. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. The United States has reimposed economic sanctions against Iran, targeting a wide range of sectors, including automobiles, its trade in gold and other precious metals, and its currency. U.S. President Donald Trump tweeting on Tuesday morning, quote, "The Iran sanctions have officially been cast. These are the most biting sanctions ever imposed, and in November, they ratchet up to yet another level. Anyone doing business with Iran will not be doing business with the United States. I am asking for world peace, nothing less." Iranians are bracing for the repercussions, while neighboring Arab states are eager to see the sanctions place pressure on their regional nemesis. Edward Uranian has that story from Cairo.
أقر الرئيس الأمريكي دونالد ترامب على أمر تنفيذي بإعادة فرض العقوبة الاقتصادية على إيران.
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV and other Gulf media focused their newscasts Monday on the new U.S. sanctions that were due to begin going into effect against Iran Tuesday. Various proxy wars between Shiite Iran and the Sunni Arab Gulf states in places such as Yemen, Syria, and Iraq have created a bitter rivalry that has left each side rejoicing at the misfortunes of the other. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA that he was surprised by the enthusiasm expressed in some Saudi media over the new sanctions, but that Riyadh is ultimately hoping to resume dialogue with Tehran.
I was reading Saudi and Riyadh newspapers this morning, and they were celebrating the imposition of the sanctions, but at the same time, the Saudis gave the head of the Iranian intersection in Jeddah along with his team pleased to enter Saudi Arabia, which means the Saudis are interested in engaging the Iranians as well, even if they are reluctant to do so at the time being.
Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr tells VOA that both the impending sanctions and the ongoing conflict between Iran and its Arab neighbors conjure up bitter memories of the Iran-Iraq War during the 1980s.
On a une expérience de la guerre de 8 ans entre l'Irak et l'Iran. Qu'est-ce que signifie cette guerre?
He says that the experience of the 8-year war between Iraq and Iran is still fresh in the minds of the Iranian people. If you tell the Iranian people, he argues, that they have to submit to U.S., British, or Russian domination, that is one thing. But he insists if you tell them that they must submit to the orders of the Saudis, that's a more bitter pill to swallow. Bani Sadr adds that he does not think that U.S. President Donald Trump is the real instigator of the new sanctions, but rather that he is following the lead of the Saudis, Israelis, and the other Gulf monarchs. He claims that many Iranians believe that Arab oil money is cajoling Trump into supporting the Saudis against Iran, and that the Iranian people consider this to be an unacceptable humiliation. Trump's executive order reimposing sanctions on Iran is effective on Tuesday, including prohibitions on selling gold or U.S. dollars to Iran, sanctions on the country's automotive sector, and purchases of jetliners. Exports of drugs, medical devices, and foodstuffs are excluded from the list of new sanctions. Sanctions against Iran were lifted following the 2015 Iran nuclear deal between Tehran and the 5 permanent UN Security Council members, plus Germany. Trump officially withdrew from that agreement on May 8. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Chicago's police chief and mayor are appealing to the public for help in identifying those responsible for 66 people being shot. VOA's Jeff Custer reports 12 of those shootings were fatal. The acts of violence all occurred in the span of just 24 hours.
Monday, Chicago's police chief Eddie Johnson said police are following promising leads into the weekend's violence, but more help is needed.
These shootings are not random. They are fueled by gang conflicts. We know who they are, and we continue to send a message that it's okay to commit these crimes by not doing anything as a community. We are all supposed to be on the same side. CPD can be better, but this city can be better.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel Monday also urged people to report those they believe were responsible for the weekend shootings. More than 300 people have been shot to death in Chicago so far this year, the most of any U.S. city. However, Chicago police say shooting deaths are down by 25% from the same time last year and say 5,500 illegal guns have been confiscated since January. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
And this is International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Jean-Pierre Bemba, the former Democratic Republic of Congo vice president, is planning to run for president in the December election. Bemba's ICC war crimes conviction was recently overturned on appeal. Politics in the DRC on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. India's first disabled dance troupe performs a lively, foot-stomping folk dance that's popular in the northern state of Punjab. The troupe is enthralling audiences around the country with their energetic performances. Over the years, the Rising Star Dance Troupe has grown from 4 to 14 members, and many of their members are now in their 40s and 50s. Ananja Prasarichup reports their enthusiasm remains steadfast.
Preparing for another performance, Jagdish Singh recalls how he once thought it was a far-fetched idea for the troupe to put on the Bhangra for an audience. Punjab's folk dance involves energetic hand and foot movements. Singh lost an arm when he was 12.
We used to rehearse behind closed doors because we were embarrassed. We felt very awkward the first time we went on stage, but people who saw our performance encouraged us.
The man who convinced him to do the Bhangra more than 20 years ago is Harinder Paul Singh, a polio victim who vowed to put together his own dance company after being mocked for trying to join a normal dance troupe.
After completing my studies, there was a deep desire in my heart to do something that normal people do, so that I feel I'm on par with them.
From just 4 members, the Rising Star troupe has expanded steadily. The youngest, Kartar Singh, took almost 10 years to learn how to beat an Indian drum called the dhol, despite a 70% disability in his arm.
I learned how to tuck in this elbow so that with its support, my hand reaches the drum. I found a way to use my fingers, but I still could not stand up and beat the drum. Then I devised a way to do that. I had to find a way around everything.
The dancers have modified some steps to put less weight on one leg, but their zest and energy makes it difficult to spot their disabilities. But it's tough work.
To perform Bhangra with our handicap in our arms and legs is like making a kite fly without a string.
Achieving that has brought them an abundance of confidence, social acceptance and recognition. Qualities that helped them, they say, find wives.
All our wives are normal girls. And in society, because of our achievement, now our friends say, we are handicapped, you are normal.
This celebratory dance is traditionally performed at weddings and festivals. But for these men, the Bhangra has become a celebration of their achievements. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
62-year-old Indra Nooyi has announced she is stepping down in October as chief executive of giant soft drink multinational PepsiCo after 12 years at the helm. She will remain chairwoman until early next year. The announcement ends a storied career with PepsiCo that extends nearly 25 years for the Indian-born woman, a rare sight among leaders of the Fortune 500 corporations. The company's revenues nearly doubled under her leadership as she moved it toward a more nutritious portfolio of drinks and snacks. IHS Global Insight Chief Economist Rajiv Biswas has followed Nooyi's career. He told VOA's Victor Beatty, she is an iconic figure in India, coming from a middle-class family in the southern city of Chennai, educated and entering the corporate world there before attaining a scholarship to attend the Yale School of Management in 1978. She joined PepsiCo in 1994 and attained her current post in 2006.
At a time when there's a lot of concerns in many countries about trying to develop women in leadership positions in all different sorts of areas, in government, in business, and other areas, she really has set a very high standard in terms of what needs to be done and what can be done. And I think also in terms of diversity, she's also iconic that, you know, an Indian who moved over to the U.S. and started pretty much at the bottom, worked all the way up to becoming the CEO and chairperson of PepsiCo. I think one of the great achievements that she's brought into industry in the U.S. and also globally is to really encourage more female talent to develop. But I think her approach was very much based on developing a pipeline of succession and not just having it by regulatory mandate, which is the government approach that some governments are now taking. But her approach is saying, well, we really got to look at your whole talent pipeline. How do you develop the talent over time? And I think that's really a very important value added that she's bringing to that whole debate. Obviously, as a business leader, she transformed PepsiCo. She moved it much more towards a healthy mix of products. And so I think also from that point of view, her success as a business leader is also very important to recognize.
Well, this also must be a very proud moment for India, given her accomplishments.
There's quite a few Indian business leaders who have become prominent in the U.S. You know, there has been considerable examples of success, but she's at the very top of the list amongst highly respected business leaders and an example for young, you know, talented Indians who think, well, I can start, you know, pretty much at the bottom of a, you know, multinational or other kind of corporate and work my way to the top. Now, of course, Indian business is also becoming much more globalized. There's a lot of Indian multinationals that are very large global players. So I think it's also important in the Indian context to encourage talented Indian women to be ambitious for the top roles within Indian multinationals as well. And there are Indian women leaders who are very, very successful. It's interesting to see her success in the U.S. I think it's also a very big positive for the U.S. that it's such an open multicultural society that someone can come from India, especially a woman, and work all the way up to the very top of one of the biggest U.S. multinationals. It's a fabulous example of, I think, the diversity and multiculturalism of the U.S., which actually elsewhere in the world is probably not really there in that many other countries.
Indra Nooyi told Bloomberg News she plans to advocate for more women to serve at the highest level in corporations. And before I go, on this day in 1998, terrorist bombs at U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania killed 224 people, including 12 Americans. And that's going to do it for International Edition today. I'd like to thank you for joining me and spending part of your day with us. To keep up with the latest, be sure to follow Voice of America on social media. Huge thanks to Patrice Martin for directing today's program and to Nashwan Kayla for engineering the broadcast. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Religious freedom is often called America's first freedom. It is the first freedom America's founders included in the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights. Speaking at the recently concluded Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom, Vice President Mike Pence declared the United States will continue to lead the world by example in promoting this freedom. The Vice President expressed concern over growing religious intolerance in many countries around the world, including countries in Europe. In Russia, for example, more than 170,000 Jehovah's Witnesses are legally banned from practicing their faith. Government agents have seized Jehovah's Witnesses' headquarters near St. Petersburg, raided their prayer halls across the country, and arrested and imprisoned scores of believers. Just 70 years after the Holocaust, attacks on Jews in Europe, even on aging Holocaust survivors, are growing at an alarming rate. The United States is also concerned about increasing incidents of anti-Muslim hatred. The United States is working with many European governments and multilateral organizations, like the European Union and Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, to combat anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim discrimination. The American people will always cherish religious freedom, and we will always stand with peoples across the world, including Europe, who stand for their faith.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.